Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier.
Starting all over again is gonna be rough. So rough. But we gonna make it. Oh yeah.
My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS 89.5 FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, I've talked to you several times on this show about an absolutely wonderful organization called We the People, and of course about my good friends at the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. They're the very people who sponsor We the People, both in the Commonwealth of Virginia and in the District of Columbia. And I've shared with you some of my adventures when I've gone and judged both at the regional and the state and even at the national levels for We the People. And so it should come as no surprise to you that I had the same experience this year. I went down to Williamsburg, Virginia, Colonial Williamsburg, is one of my favorite places on the planet, which is where the Virginia State Finals were held this year. And I did a little bit of judging, and I did lots and lots of talking, and I met lots and lots of people. But that's not exactly what I'm going to talk about this time. This is not actually a We the People episode. It's sort of an opportunistic episode that's piggybacked on the back of my recent trip. Because you see, when I was at the We the People competition, I met some other people with whom I spoke, and that's going to be my focus today. The primary person with whom I spoke was a fascinating fellow. He was a keynote speaker at the We the People competition. His name is Chris Phillips. And Chris Phillips is an author, a serial author. He's committed this crime more than once. Some years ago, he wrote a book called Socrates Cafe. And he's more recently written one called Constitution Cafe. Now, those are some interesting titles, aren't they? Both of them have the idea of having a Socratic dialogue. All you liberal arts majors will remember that. The idea that people get together and they talk about big ideas and they do it in a critical fashion and they question each other. And it's all done in a spirit of inquiry, but it's very incisive. He started that years ago with the Socrates Cafe Project, traveled all around the country, wrote up a book and talked about some big ideas. But then more recently, he wrote this second book, the premise of which is based on Thomas Jefferson. It seems that Thomas Jefferson, among all the many interesting things he said over his life, once suggested that it'd be a good idea to tear up the Constitution about every 20 years and just start all over again. Because dead people, old people, shouldn't rule present people. Those of us who are living now need to have our own form of government. Maybe every 20 years or so it'd be a good chance for us all to get together and decide what we're going to do. But actually, it turns out that we haven't followed Jefferson's advice, doesn't it? In fact, we're getting close to the 226th anniversary of the original adoption of our Constitution. And we haven't really changed fundamentally the structure of that document. Oh, we've made some very important changes, but it's basically still the same structure of government, the same basic ideas that we had going all the way back to the summer of 1787. And Chris Phillips thinks maybe it's time to change that. I started out by asking Chris what kind of guy would suggest that we tear up the Constitution and start all over again.
Starting all over again is gonna be hard.
Well, I'm a kid from Newport News, Virginia. Got a miserable public school education. I hope my teachers aren't listening. Mm-hmm. And then I went on to the College of William & Mary to study government.
A fine place.
After I first spent a year at the University of Virginia as an engineering student, where I hated every second.
Engineering?
Yeah, my dad was an electrical engineer.
Oh, so he wanted you to be an engineer.
Yeah, I was good in math, and I hated it. So I took out a student loan, and I decided to go transfer to William & Mary and major, study this thing called liberal arts.
Right.
And so my dad, he didn't like the fact that I had taken out a loan because now he couldn't tell me what to do.
Right.
I mean, I understood. He was a child of the Depression. He was his family, poor Greek immigrants through Ellis Island. He wanted me to have a stable profession, but I just wanted to learn. I felt like this was going to be my chance to learn. So ultimately, I took some philosophy classes or sat in, and I didn't like professors reading papers and monotone voices. It wasn't my idea of what philosophy was supposed to be. So I gravitated to political philosophy in the government department. And I hit pay dirt for me. I was fascinated with something. I had no idea how or whether I was ever going to be able to get a job, but I found something. And one of the things I studied decades ago at the College of William & Mary was the thought of Thomas Jefferson, who graduated as alum.
I understand he thought a great deal.
Yeah, he graduated.
He had lots of very important thoughts that we need to discuss. Yeah, right.
You can tell. He graduated about 3 years before I did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. You are getting up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see the gray. But one of his ideas that wasn't taken very seriously in his time, but that spoke to me, and I wrote a paper about it, was that he believed that the Constitution needed to be rewritten from scratch every 20 years, or at least that we needed to, as he put it, take a tally, go start through from the preamble and work our way through each generation. Every 20 years, a new generation supposedly emerged of adults. But that they should ask themselves, is this really the scaffolding for governance that we want? Are these really the rights and the responsibilities that we want? But that they needed to have that debate among themselves. He believed that we did our framers and founders, the signers of the Declaration, a disservice if we looked at their works as iconic, that if we have to believe that the human mind and heart progresses and that we can create documents, foundational law that mirrors that. And so he did make that suggestion. He wrote his own draft after draft model of an ideal constitution as he saw it for the Commonwealth of Virginia. But his idea just never took hold. But at a time when there's so much polarization in the United States, at a time when people across the political spectrum believe that our government is woefully dysfunctional, I began to ask myself, could it be that the Constitution itself is a facilitator of this dysfunctionality? Can it be that it's an impediment of helping us achieve our higher hopes and dreams? Now,
so you're challenging Holy Writ.
I'm challenging the most sacred of sacred documents. Now, there's another thing. The Center for the Constitution, Montpelier, had done a national survey, which they asked folks. It was comprehensive. They asked, older American voters whether they would make any changes to the Constitution. And, of course, most said absolutely not.
Never.
But they asked the younger folks between, 18 and 36, would you make any changes? And a decided block of them said they would. But here's what these two groups had in common. Hadn't read the Constitution.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Extraordinary.
It's not extraordinary. It's remarkable.
It's chilling.
Chilling. There's another good word. I joined the military when I was 18 years old.
Right.
19 years old. Okay. And I took this oath to preserve and protect the Constitution. I had never read it.
Okay.
I had just promised to defend this with my life.
Right.
Right?
Even though you...
And I never read it.
4,300 some odd words. Totally accessible. We haven't read it.
I've never read it, exactly.
Don't feel bad, because the Speaker of the House of Representatives talked about how he loved the fact that the Constitution holds certain truths to be self-evident.
Oh, no.
He was talking about the Declaration.
Yes, he was.
They read it at the opening of each session, and he doesn't even know what's
good
in the Constitution.
Heavens. Oh, man.
So don't feel bad at all. It's pathetic.
Well, I've read it since.
Okay, I think so.
I've read it since.
Yes. And it's kind of cool that the president is a former professor of constitutional law.
That is interesting,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I don't.
We've actually had two, Bill Clinton as
that's
well.
That's right. Well, I don't make that statement to make people feel bad, because I had to ask myself, well, what do I know about it? See, I don't write about things I know about. I write about things that I'm curious about.
Right.
And so I thought, well, what if I took Jefferson up in an imaginative way on this idea? And I travel across the fruited plain and ask very motley groups of Americans to put on a framer's hat and ask yourself, what would you change if you could, if anything? And my thought was that rather than sort of didactic instruction, this is what the Constitution says, and then sort of engaging in pontifical discourse about what my interpretation is and yours.
Yeah, that's what I do.
That's right. That's what law professors
do.
And I didn't want to step on your turf.
Oh, okay, okay. Good.
Because I understand.
Stand
people
your side.
Need to make a living.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So I thought the other thing is that this will help us come to a greater appreciation of what our framers accomplished. I mean, it's an extraordinary feat. Yeah, there were wealthy white guys who weren't as different as the regular American populace as you can get, for worse, but also for better. I mean, they were prescient in their own way. So part of my plan was, by having this sort of forward-looking thing where we're asking ourselves, what, if any, changes could we make, starting with a preamble and working our way through the Constitution, article by article, we would, if nothing else, gain some semblance of constitutional literacy. We would know what's...
Because we use read the darn thing.
Well, we use the existing Constitution as the template for very rich discussion on what we would change. And even if we... I mean, this is an imaginative affair, but it gives us, by actually weighing in on what it says and what we would change, we feel more absorbed in it. We immerse ourselves more in it than if we were... just taking like a law school class or something like that. How's that, just to bite you in the...
No, that's true.
I'm just kidding.
Well, you know, I think a lot of law school classes are that way. So, right. Yeah, absolutely. You really want to go back to the beginning. Yeah. So that was a very interesting premise.
So I set out on this quest to look... I believed it would give me a much greater appreciation of what our framers did. It would give me an excuse after all these decades to delve, to dust off my paper that I wrote on Jefferson's thought as it pertained to the Constitution and delve into it much, much more deeply. Mm-hmm. And to come to a much keener appreciation of the law of the land and how it pervades every aspect of our lives, and whether, in fact, there are vital changes that need to be made or... I mean, people came up with some really rich ideas,
You took the show on the road, Chris.
Where'd you go? I went to People's Park in Berkeley. I went down to the OC, Orange County. I went to the Mall of America where they have a roller coaster inside of the food, by the food.
I've heard that.
Yeah. I mean, as the roller coaster was going, as the security guard was looking at me, because I have this sign that says Constitution Working Group, and he's thinking I'm a terrorist, I am having these rich Constitution Cafe discourses.
Wait a second. How do you start this up? You go to the Mall of America. You go to OZ.
Social media.
Okay.
Meetup.com.
Oh, okay. So you're actually arranging these things in advance.
Oh, yeah.
Good. I mean, you're just not approaching someone.
No,
don't go into the gap now. I'm going to come over here
and talk
to you about
the... Here's
what
you do.
Okay.
You get a seed group through social media and things. Okay. So, like, you start out with 10, but you put yourself in a place where people on their harried way to the Gap or someplace else look at these crazies sitting down and talking about the Constitution. Here I am holding my, pocket version of the Constitution, like a pocket Bible or something. And all of a sudden, people stop and they go, "What is going on?" And they freeze. And they sit down and they take part. So that's half the fun, is I never know quite who's going to take part. These are public gatherings, except when I'm in prison. So far they've let me out.
Not public.
Yes. But they are. And that's, to me, that's part of the thrill of doing it, as I put myself intentionally in places where hopefully that random passerby will also participate. Yes.
That sounds very cool. And the premise is, what would you do if you could rewrite the Constitution? And in fact, your book is organized in that way. You go through
it
and
is.
So what did people come up with?
Well, so let's start with a preamble.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a high school.
That we the people part. Right.
I went to a high school not far from where my mom was born and raised, in a coal mining camp. I'd been in touch with the teacher there who had read my first book, Socrates Cafe, and I told him about my new project, and I went in and I held a dialogue there. And it was fascinating because it was those students actually, it's West Virginia. The late Robert Byrd had actually gotten a law passed that said any school that receives any modicum of federal funding does have to have some teaching segment or module on the Constitution, at least on Constitution Day.
Right.
And this school actually...
Including us.
Yeah.
And we do that every year.
All right. Well,
right.
This school actually did it. So they had just read the Constitution, but they'd also just a week earlier read the Declaration. And they were fascinated by the fact that the language in the Declaration spoke to them, whereas they thought that the language in the Constitution read like someone a little... maybe from the Russian Politburo. It's just very different.
Yeah, it is a different document.
Yeah, very,
and
yeah.
The preamble, and I have to defend that. I mean, that the preamble is pretty cool.
I love the preamble.
The preamble is good.
Yeah. I'm just telling you, this is what high school students felt.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
nothing really compares with the Declaration.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. They've just finished reading the rabble-rousing Declaration,
right.
So it does. Even the preamble is much more toned down after that.
Look, it's Jefferson. It's okay. He had a way with words, okay? I mean, you gotta give it to the guy.
He's not a good speaker, but the man can write.
He can write.
He really knows his business.
Yep.
So, and they wanted, they believed that, they were actually a little bit appalled that none of the rich language about having that all people were created equal, all men are created equal, that we all have the equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was anywhere to be seen in the Constitution, though the Constitution's reason for being is because of the Declaration. So they, since the preamble sets the stage for everything that's to come, they wanted to include some language from the Declaration in that preamble. And I thought, that's why not? This is what speaks to this generation, that they had reached out over the Constitution back to the Declaration, and it had spoken to them and touched them at a time when people right and left, actually, from Tea Party members to Occupy members, are issuing their own declarations of independence again.
Right.
Why? Because they feel like either the Constitution is not being obeyed, or that it's no longer serving its purpose. And in either case, it means that we're in some trouble somewhere.
Right.
But they believe if we need to keep our eyes on the prize, so we need that language, that fiery revolutionary language right in the Declaration itself. And one of the reasons was because they believe that the Constitution itself should institutionalize revolution.
Very interesting.
I mean, the whole idea is that if Jefferson believed that we're going to continually have bloody revolution after a certain number of years if not all of us don't feel like we're invested stakeholders in the process. His quote was that everyone, and he was president at the time when he says, from the president on down, is going to become like wolves if the people are divorced from the corridors of power.
Right.
And I think he's pretty much proven.
Well, that's a very interesting thing. We've actually had people on the show before who've talked about the crisis in participation and how so few people even vote, let alone participate between elections in the process of government. And of course, one definition of the American experiment is simply, and the one I think this is probably the best, is simply the question is, can people govern themselves? Can free people govern themselves? Well, if you don't govern, if you don't participate, well then the answer is no.
Right. Well, we have to ask ourselves, what do we mean by govern? What do we mean by governing ourselves? Do we mean by just going and voting every 2 to 4 years? Or should there be more to it than that? Jefferson, and I write about this in my book, he talked he wanted this system of governance called the ward system. And he proposed a very intimate series of what he called mini republics. Vastness was no impediment to this, where people... Everybody took part in some way as a representative, and where it was a bottom-up form of governance, where the people on the lowest rungs called the shots, and those at the highest rungs took their marching orders from them. I mean, that was his proposal, and that all these mini republics together would comprise a true democracy. Again, it was an idea that was given short shrift in its day. It's an idea that I find fascinating, and I would love to see put into practice, but there's representation and there's representation. One of the dialogues I had in Constitution Cafe was between a current member of Congress and a retired member of Congress. And I asked them, and they had to overcome this sort of sense that, we just can't even talk imaginatively about changing this thing. It's just not what we do. I mean, it's like encroaching on our fiefdoms of power or something like that. But once they got into this imaginative exercise, they talked about the fact that, look, if you really want genuine representativeness, then go back to the original idea of our framers. They gave us the right to have one member of Congress per every 30,000 constituents.
Yeah, they did.
We still have that. People don't realize that.
But we don't have that. We have, what, about 180, 200,000?
We have one congressman for about every 720,000 constituents.
Is it that many now?
Oh, it's obscene.
Forgive my ignorance. I thought it was 200,000.
We've got over 300 million citizens. Mm-hmm. We've got 435 members of Congress.
Oh, boy, I guess I should have done the arithmetic.
You cannot have genuine representation when every one congressperson has 700,000 constituents. It's an impossibility. Can't happen.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Christopher Phillips, the author, most recently, of the book Constitution Cafe, a book based on his adventures going across our great nation, talking to people about how they would rewrite the Constitution if they only have the chance. Chris was just telling me that he thinks one thing we could do without rewriting the Constitution is have a lot more members of Congress. I don't know how that would play politically, but he does have an argument. After the break, we'll talk some more to Chris, and we'll also have a special visit from his inspiration. Stay tuned. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Chris Phillips about his remarkable book, The Constitution Cafe, in which he picks up on Thomas Jefferson's suggestion that maybe we should revisit our Constitution every 20 years or so. We were also visited while I was out at Williamsburg with Chris. We were also visited by a very nice fellow by the name of Bill Barker, who is the official interpreter of Thomas Jefferson at Colonial Williamsburg. And here's just a brief excerpt from Bill's speech as Thomas Jefferson to the We the People final competitors.
"That we might never forget, we are the first people in the history of mankind to found a nation upon principle. Not upon monarchy, nor rest you assured upon aristocracy. Principles that have been argued and debated from time immemorial as to whether man is capable of governing himself, and how well we know there are some of our citizen body who do not believe that man is so capable. Oh, they find one and the other, do they not? They huddle closely together. They believe that our government, our system of laws, has been instituted solely to protect and defend themselves from their fellow citizens. But I ask you, where would they be more free upon this globe to hold that opinion? And at the same time, to be opposed by their fellow citizen who has a contrary opinion, who seeks the collaboration of their fellow man to continue to move this nation towards improving the condition of mankind, who continue to reflect upon where we have been to better understand where we are, and the more so, but perhaps a clearer understanding of where we may be going, for rest you assured, we sail through uncharted waters. Man has never been here before."
That was Bill Barker, the official interpreter of Thomas Jefferson for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, speaking to the recent Virginia State Finals of the We the People competition. Wasn't Bill great? Now let's return to our discussion with Chris Phillips, who was inspired by Jefferson to suggest some pretty radical restructuring of our own Constitution. Interestingly enough, at the moment, we're only talking about redoing something within our existing Constitution, that is, increasing the number of representatives in Congress.
If we went back, again, it would take just a simple majority vote by Congress right now to suddenly start increasing. They gradually increased the members of Congress as our population increased. What happened in the 1920s, I believe, don't quote me on that, but suddenly most of our population growth was in urban places. Mm-hmm. And the nativists among Congress didn't like the fact that suddenly representation was getting skewed towards those areas. And so they curtailed from then on out any further expansion of the members of Congress. So we've been stuck at 435 members for about 100 years. Just a simple majority vote But we don't have to make any amendment or anything to have genuine representativeness again. All we have to do is go back to increasing the number. Now,
how many members of Congress would we have if we had one for every 30,000?
We would have about 10,000.
10,000 yeah. members of Congress. Now, of course, people look at that and they say, wait a second, where would you put them?
Well, a stadium. Uh-huh. That's what the Greeks of old did. They mm-hmm. corralled the first 5,000 folks who went up, I'm getting my language wrong, the Acropolis, Parthenon.
Yeah, one of those places. I don't know.
Anyway.
They stuck them all in one big stadium.
They did. Okay. They stuck them all in one big stadium, and they had at it. If they could have done it back then without any social media, without internet or cyberspace, 5,000, I think we can easily house 10,000 and create ways with all of our social media and mechanisms, create really interesting types of intimacy among them, communication. Now, you might say, well, it would be cacophony. It would be chaos. Well, wouldn't that be wonderful? Right now, they don't even talk to each other. I mean, anything's better than what's going on right now. And one of the reasons is they all have these fiefdoms, and they know that unless they do something extraordinarily stupid, they're going to be there for a long time to come.
Mm-hmm.
So for every one member of... And here's another thing. Let's say that you had... Every member of Congress has about 23 unelected staffers. So you have one representative and all these unelected folks working around it to maintain that big fiefdom, actually.
Right.
Do away with those 23 unelected staffers. Supplant them with elected members of Congress, and all of a sudden you have the same number that you have now. In fact, you probably have less if you do away with all the other unelected staffers who work for the Congressional Budget Office and all these other agencies. It's doable. It's absolutely doable. And it would take just a simple majority vote in Congress. They would have to vote for resuscitating a genuine democratic republic rather than what we have
today.
Well,
but you see, of course, the direct political problem. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you're diluting your power.
You are.
Yeah, I mean, that's the basic problem with that proposal, is that will any politician ever want to simply represent 30,000 one day when he's been representing close to a million the day before?
All right, but I take great hope and heart in the fact that I did get this current member of Congress and one former member to agree that it needed to be done. They did. For the good of our democracy. Look, we're on a downward slope. There's no question about it. The only time that elected officials or anyone will actually bring about change if they feel that if they don't, all is lost anyway. I'm not much of a doomsayer, but given the fact of how unrepresentative our representatives are today, we may reach a point where the people become so dissatisfied that they might make such a hue and cry that Congress finally does heed them. Will they allow one congressperson for every 23? No. But maybe they'll up the number to 500, and then the next census 700. At least then it would be, one member of Congress for every, 400,000, which is better than what we have. So it might be done in increments. But the fact is that they did that. They had the best interest of our nation at heart when they kept gradually increasing, just like our founders wanted. James Madison, when he presented his proposed amendments to the Constitution after Jefferson had sort of pushed him for a Bill of Rights, he wanted one of the amendments to actually be. There were 12 that he proposed. One of them was to have around 50,000, well, one member of Congress for every 50,000. So he believed that that's what we needed as well. He wanted something etched more in stone than that you can have up to one member for every 30,000, because this is what it's come to, and we have a totally unrepresentative system now. It's representative in name only.
Yeah, that is sobering to think about that. If, I mean, more than 500,000 people are represented by each congressman, what real power does any one of us individually have, especially if you're just your average Joe? You're not some fancy guy with some fancy degree or some high-paying job. I mean, how are you going to get in to see your congressman?
Right. But here's the other beauty of if we ever did make our system representative again. All these folks who are talking about that we need amendments that ban contributions from PACs, for instance, that we need amendments that state explicitly that corporations are not persons. It would obviate the need for those amendments.
Do you think so?
Here's why. Let's imagine that we had one Congress member for every 30,000. Well, all of a sudden, anybody could throw his hat in the ring. Anybody. I mean, it doesn't take, especially again in this age of cyberspace, if you're only having to run for office with a constituency of 30,000, it's very easy to get your message out. You don't need a lot of money. You can come up with all kinds of creative ways to get the message out. So you're not beholden on the patch. You're not, in fact, if we had one representative for every 30,000 people, I dare say it would have revolutionary implications in the type of economy we have. I don't think it would be an economy run by corporate behemoths anymore.
You know, that is fascinating, Chris, and now that you mention it, years and years ago, I actually ran for office and lost, but it was the number of people who were voting was about 22, 23,000 people, and I ran the election on a shoestring. It really was just a few thousand dollars. It was mm-hmm. something that I could do. It's something that almost anybody could do. And, you know, even though I lost, I came pretty close. I mean, I ran a credible campaign on a shoestring budget.
That is remarkable.
I didn't need corporate contributions.
Did you run under a party banner?
Yeah, I had to.
You did?
Basically, there was only one party in town.
Okay.
And I'm not going to say which party it was. It's a nonpartisan show, and this was 20 years ago.
Right.
But basically, yeah. I mean, basically, the whole election was going to be decided in a primary, and therefore everybody, you know, ran under party auspices. But you didn't need the party's support. In fact, you didn't get it because you're in a primary. They're not going to pick and choose among members of that particular party. And it was very much a mom-and-pop sort of thing. I mean, you know, sure, money helps, but what was remarkable was that we were able to run a credible campaign for a relatively small amount of money. That certainly tends to undergird what you've just said.
Right. Look, our framers were ingenious. They created a system that allowed us to have one member of Congress for every 30,000. No constitutional amendment needed. All we have to do is demand it. We have to demand that we have the representative democracy, the constitutional republic that they intended us to have.
That's fascinating. But we could talk about that all day. What were some of the other reforms that your people at your Constitution Cafe recommended?
One of my favorites actually sort of is the most foundational at all. I got together with people at the Green Dragon Tavern in where the original Tea Party, Boston Tea Party members way back when had orchestrated the Boston Tea Party. And the group that got together with me, they wanted to know, well, has there ever been a country, open or closed, in which there was a democratic mechanism or any mechanism at all for choosing the framers of a constitution? In other words, we have many so-called open societies, but has there ever been a democratic election that chooses the framers? Can you name one?
Well, that's very interesting because, of course, in our own circumstance, we had a call for a constitutional convention. And I guess we did have the state legislatures, didn't we, nominating people and sending them?
The old buddy network.
It was a small group of people.
A very small group.
But I mean, there was some sort of representative process, wasn't there, for picking?
It was a self-selected, self-elected group of people who met behind closed doors.
I know they met
behind, I love them dearly.
Now,
but
that part I know. They met behind closed doors. We can talk about that some other time.
Right.
But the actual selection of these people, why I was under the impression that it was something that was done.
They met to consider making changes to the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. There was not even any thought among most of them that there was going to be a constitutional convention. They were going to start from scratch.
Okay.
That was Hamilton's and Madison's thing.
Right.
They knew, and they managed to steer enough. I mean, by the time all was said and done, there were only 39 left.
Right.
Too many others smelled a rat. That's not what they'd come to do.
Right.
I mean, the Constitutional Convention, Stuart, was unconstitutional.
People have talked about that fact, but you know it's so hard to argue with success, isn't it?
It's I'm not arguing with success. I'm just saying this is how it happened.
Yeah.
Sometimes the best things are born by skirting around. I mean the law, the mm-hmm. Articles of Confederation had a hard and fast stipulation that any changes whatsoever, not even one word, had to be agreed on by all the 13 states. Any change, and that. delegates from all the 13 states had to be there. And, of course, Rhode Island didn't even show up.
That's unworkable. Yeah. Unanimity is unworkable. That was one of the problems with the articles, wasn't it?
That's still what... Look, that was the Constitution. That was our Constitution, and that's what it said. So now we're saying, okay, well, if we feel the same way, then we don't really have to abide by our existing Constitution.
Our Constitution. I mean, I'll actually put your question back on you.
All right.
I don't know if there ever has been a circumstance where a country has simply said, as a populace, you know, as a group... Let's have a constitution, and let's start with very democratic principles.
Right.
You know, let's have ward elections or whatever we're going to do.
Right.
And look what's happening in the Middle East right now.
Right. Well, there's all these emerging democracies.
Right. But they all come out.
They all emerge
in some sort of way. You've got a bunch of elites that get together.
Exactly.
And they basically say, okay, you know, we got to figure this out. Let's do it.
The elites never ask for input from the no matter how admirable the document is, no matter how sublime some of it may be. They never ask ordinary folks, what would you like to see in it?
But doesn't it quick? I mean, if you do that, okay, if you do that, if like right now in Egypt, they said, okay, let's all get together. Right. I mean, it turns into Occupy.
All right, but then let's just say.
Right, I mean, Occupy had, that was the most recent example we've had of pure democracy.
No, look, it's not going to happen. Don't worry.
Oh, I'm not worried in the least, but I find this very interesting because Occupy, I mean, okay, fine, noble ideals, completely unworkable. It just collapsed.
Well, I think that you can create mechanisms that would allow for thoughtful discourse to happen. Look, what we need to do is resuscitate the kinds of dialogue virtues that our founders had. These people were extraordinarily different for their time and climate. They had very different views in many ways.
They did,
what they agreed upon was reform.
Elites. Those are the very elites you're talking about.
I think whether it's the elites or the quotidian, I think that what we need is to cultivate a type of system in which everybody matters and counts. Once they realize that their voice really does matter, they'll tone it down. And they'll actually thoughtfully begin to participate.
I'm not going to disagree with you.
Equal recognition.
I just don't know how you get to that point.
You know what? You get to it by just starting. If we really don't have this Jeffersonian faith in people to sort of rise to their higher angels, then we'll never get there. If we keep sort of stooping to the lowest denominator. And again, look at who our elites are today. These are people who don't have anything to do with one another, much less with their constituents or anybody.
Right.
So... Here's my profound statement. What do we got to lose? But the idea is that rather than have an election, if you really want a genuine representative group to serve as framers, you do a random sample. And it has to be
big enough. Random people off the street.
Random. Not pick them off the street, but like a pollster would pick a random sample. That would be a legitimate random sampling. So it would have to be large enough.
This is Jeffersonianism taken to egalitarianism is the most equal thing I've ever heard.
Just imagine if we did it even as a mock constitutional convention platform. I think it would be fascinating. We'd actually James Fishkin.
Uh-huh.
And his idea of the random sampling model has been applied elsewhere.
People like me would no longer be in charge.
Yes, and...
But see, that's the point.
So that gives me hope.
It comes up every year in my con law class, what is the perfect form of government? And I have the same answer. It's me as king.
Yes.
Okay?
And you and Plato would get along great.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's me as king because I would agree with every decision the government made.
It'd be called the you-demand form of government.
You demand. Exactly right. Well, I'm willing to give that up, but I don't know.
That's really magnanimous of
you. Thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate that. I'm an egalitarian guy, but I don't know that I'm so egalitarian that I'm going to say, let's just do a computer program and pick people off the street randomly.
Jefferson believed in what I would call egalitarian elitism. I mean, he wanted a natural aristocracy where there was a level playing field where everybody would get a really high-quality Renaissance kind of education so that the cream of the crop would naturally arise out of that.
Which is a good end point, but I mean, that's not where you're starting.
Well, it's not where we're starting, but look, every reform that Jefferson ever proposed, from great public school education, truly great public school education, was shot down by the elites because they didn't want everybody to have that kind of education. Imagine if we had started out, our nation, with this great experiment where everybody genuinely had received that kind of education where we all became truly enlightened generalists, just like the Greeks of old. Then, when we did our random sampling, we'd have people of incredible wide-reaching realms of intelligence and intellectual experience and all kinds of...
But then I might not have ended up on the top.
Well,
somebody else might have this radio show.
Right.
I don't know if I like that.
Yeah. I think it's probably time for you to just let me take over the show. And I'm just kidding.
This is what you're talking about. No. This is revolutionary.
I know.
I mean, this really is revolutionary.
It's revolutionary in the best sense because it's bloodless.
Right.
It prevents what's going to happen if we don't do something like this. And we always say it's never going to happen, but it does.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Christopher Phillips, who's written a fascinating book called Constitution Cafe, in which he checks out various ways in which we might go back to the beginning and rewrite our federal constitution. After the break, we'll speak a bit more with Chris Phillips, and then we'll also hear from a woman named Julie Silverbrook about something called Consource. Stick around.
Nothing's impossible, I have found. But when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, start all over again. Don't lose your confidence if you slip. Be grateful for a pleasant trip and pick yourself up, dust yourself off, start all over again. Work like a soul inspired till the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let's finish up our conversation with Christopher Phillips, author of Constitution Cafe.
That's actually one of your premises, isn't
right.
it? Is if we allow ourselves to become more and more unrepresentative, that eventually the people will simply not... First they'll disconnect, and then they'll revolt.
They will. And I think we're almost in what I would call a pre-revolutionary stage. There's such deep dissatisfaction, anger, apathy across the board, that again, I think 10 years down the road, the ideas that I'm pitching right now might not seem so outlandish. Now, can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
We actually have precedent for this.
Mm-hmm.
We can study far and wide the constitutions across the epochs and across the nations. As far as I know, there's never been one time when there's been a process for democratically electing framers except one.
Tell me.
That was our nation's own founding in the great state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, of all the colonies, actually allowed for the direct election of the framers of the Pennsylvania Constitution. And I believe Massachusetts did as well. The difference in Pennsylvania was that usually the only people who could vote in elections were property holders and taxpayers, mm-hmm. which were in white males.
Mm-hmm.
They allowed any white male to vote, even if you didn't own any property and even if you didn't pay a penny of taxes. They were not only allowed to vote for framers of the Pennsylvania Constitution, they were allowed to run to serve as framer. And so this guy named James Cannon, who was just from the class, mercantile artisan class, he led this great movement to try to get lots of ordinary folks to run for office as framers. So it was the only state constitutional convention in which the overwhelming majority of framers were regular folks. And the one exception was this doddering man who went between the Constitutional Convention in Independence Hall and the Pennsylvania State Convention, Benjamin Franklin.
Well, that was actually going to be my point, Chris, is that, okay, fine. So they had this wonderful plebiscite, but who did they elect? Benjamin Franklin, Governor Morris, James Wilson. I mean,
you're looking at looking at the wrong data.
Uh-huh.
The data, this thing that you need to look at is the Constitution they came up with. It was
I was misstating it. You were saying for the Pennsylvania Constitution.
You're talking about
me. I was talking about the Constitutional Convention.
Yes.
I don't really know who the framers of the Pennsylvania Constitution.
As much as Franklin liked the document that they came up for the federal constitution,
right,
that centralized power much better. At the state level, he really liked the idea that it should be this cauldron, this laboratory of experimentation.
Right. And they actually had a tribunal, didn't they? They had a three-person president?
Yes. So they had even a fourth branch so that any law that was passed by the legislature could be reviewed by the populace as a whole. And if a majority of them voted the law down, it was rescinded as long as they did it within a year. So it was the most egalitarian, experimental, inclusive type of democracy ever been seen before since. And
you're speaking in the past tense. Did it work?
Well, it worked for a number of years. And then the entrenched elites realized that this was undermining everything that they hoped for. Their aspirations were not the same as the regular democratic citizenry. So they spent a number of years in a demonization campaign against it, and ultimately they won out. But for several years, they had the most extraordinary experiment in democratic governance that we've ever had. So the fact that it could happen then gives me hope and heart that we can do it again. Will we ever have faith in one another to have such an open, inclusive process where anybody could actually run to serve as framers? I don't know, but we did do it once in our history. The problem these days is that we don't trust one another. If I get together with a group of MoveOrrin.org progressive types and I talk about this, they go, well, I don't want to get together with anybody who has anything to do with the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. If I get together with Tea Party types, the same deal. They don't want to have anything to do with one another. Instead of celebrating the dazzling beauties of political difference, we now look at it as anathema. And until and unless we can overcome that and realize that, look, the overwhelming majority of all these people are people who operate from sincerely held positions. They have the best interests of our country at heart, as much as we might disagree with the path they've chosen. They're all really passionate reformers. They really are thinking about how this is going to affect the generations to come. If we could understand that there's these matrices of beautiful commonality among them, even as there's great difference among the channels and pathways that they would choose for bringing about reform, I think we'd be on the road to something exciting. But we still aren't at that point where it's down to that philosophy. What do you got to lose?
Chris, you're going all Gandhi on me here. you're going all Gandhi on me. You're right. I mean, people won't talk to each other, and it's been my experience as well as yours that there are people of goodwill.
Well, I got to tell you,
the political spectrum, there really are, yeah. and it's so unfortunate that they demonize one another.
Right.
If
but
you disagree with me, you are bad.
Right.
You're immoral, and that's
right.
that. No one can compromise.
You can't.
You can't.
Not when you have that level of animosity.
Yes, yeah, extraordinary.
But again, what I've discovered more than anything else in my Constitution Cafe project. I mean, I didn't get together with just groups of people who thought alike or was just preaching to the choir. I deliberately created spaces and places where it was a very diverse group of thinkers. And what I discovered is when you model a form of discourse where people can be very impassioned, but the idea is to posit your view, try to support your view on constitutional change, big constitutional ideas, and then open it up to others where they can examine it in a thoughtful way, looking at what speaks for and against, and then using their imaginations, coming up with alternatives. I realized this is possible. There's not one dialogue I held as deeply impassioned as people were and as different as they were where the Constitution Cafe project didn't work. Sometimes it was a little tense. Sometimes mm-hmm. we did touch a lot of hot button issues. But all in all, people were more than willing to meet one another halfway. And so I found that if you model yourself as a facilitator of this type of thoughtful discourse, people rise to the occasion. I mean, I've held hundreds of these now, and I can count on one hand.
No fisticuffs?
Not yet, but I'm about ready to get it on with you.
Yeah, I've been getting kind of angry.
You really riled me, Stuart.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is terrible. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, let's get ready to rumble with the Constitution.
That's right. We'll
yeah. No, I think I emerged from this project, which is still ongoing. I mean, I've created this very thorough guide on how to start and facilitate a Constitution Cafe. If anybody ever wants to go to our website at constitutioncafe.org, they can link into it and print it out and start their own group. Right now, we've maybe got 10 groups at the most, mm-hmm. but at least that's 10 more than we had a couple years ago.
Sure.
So people are getting together.
Hey, that's what we do on the show. We talk about the Constitution, yeah. and we talk about it with people from a variety of backgrounds. So I'm very much on your side in that regard. I think the more talking, the better. The more we discuss with one another, the more we reach across whatever aisles there are and talk to people who disagree with us, the better. The only alternative to that ultimately is to beat each over the head with sticks, and that's not good.
Yeah, or we could try talking and beating each other.
The talk kind of falls by the wayside.
Yeah,
it does.
After when you're unconscious
struck,
and bleeding. Yeah,
you're right.
It's
not
never
very
mind.
Good.
Not
never
very
mind.
Good.
Call
All
me
right.
a...
romantic at heart, but yeah, you're right.
Well, any final thoughts? We're running out of time here, Chris Phillips. What any final thoughts?
Well, I think that people need to become literate about the Constitution.
Right.
At the same time, I think people need to reach out to others who do not look at things the same way they do and discuss the Constitution. And I think hopefully this Constitution Cafe project is one among many that can create bridges at the same time as we differ about things and gain a greater appreciation of this document that I believe, if we make no changes at all, can lead us to higher ground as a nation, as individuals within it.
Yes, something just occurred to me.
What?
We're sitting in a cafe.
Right.
And we're having our own little Constitution Cafe right here, aren't we?
We are.
So maybe it is possible.
Yeah, I think so. Let's channel the spirit of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison.
Right here. Right here now.
They were very close by.
Okay, I'm feeling it.
Yeah.
Okay. Chris Phillips, right. Thanks so much. Appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Time.
I'm Stuart Harris, and this is your weekly Constitutional. And wasn't that a fascinating discussion with Chris Phillips all about how to rewrite the U.S. Constitution? Now let's take a slight change of pace and speak to someone else I ran into in Colonial Williamsburg back in February. Her name is Julie Silverbrook, and she is the executive director of a fascinating organization called ConSource. And Julie sent me a copy of a very interesting document all about a fascinating case right now in front of the Supreme Court. You may have heard of it. It's called Shelby County versus Holder, and it involves Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Julie begins by telling me a little bit about her organization and then about this curious document that she sent me.
It's a document of excerpted material from historical documents exploring the scope of the 15th Amendment and its enforcement power, and we're hoping that our historical research will be used by a variety of different individuals to inform their understanding of the constitutional issues implicated by the Shelby County v. Holder Voting Rights Act challenge currently before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. That case, of course, involves Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the pre-clearance requirement for areas primarily in the South. Where there had been a history of racial discrimination in voting. And I should also mention that the 15th Amendment, of course, is the voting rights amendment that was specifically designed to establish African-American male suffrage after the Civil War. So you went all the way back to the source. You went all the way back to the 15th Amendment, and you put together a very impressive, I think it's about 50 or 60 page, what looks like a very detailed outline full of lots of excerpts from the Constitution, from statutes, from legislative histories, etc.
Yeah, and we actually went, well before the drafting and ratification of the 15th Amendment. We also looked at some founding era materials covering the topic of the regulation of elections and the division of authority between the state and national government. And so I think there's some really interesting dialogue that occurred in the founding and during some of the ratification conventions on the scope of congressional power under the Elections Clause in Article 1. So there's an interesting discussion in there on that as well. And then there's some materials from the Federalist Papers as well, which we think shed some light on the division of authority sort of pre-15th Amendment and then post-15th Amendment in terms of how the state and federal government can regulate specific aspects of elections within states.
Well, that's all, of course, very useful stuff to know, and that brings me to the document itself. What's interesting to my mind is that the document has almost no text in it. In other words, it doesn't look like you all have written very much in terms of explanation, and certainly nothing in terms of advocacy.
That's right.
This is a very generic research tool that you are making available to everyone who might be interested in this case. Is that correct?
That's right. So ConSource has a very pure, simple mission, which is just facilitating greater research and understanding of U.S. constitutional history. And all of the resources we provide, we hope, we've accomplished just being sort of a neutral facilitator of greater understanding. And so all of the background material that's included is really just to contextualize the excerpted quote from a particular historical document, and it's just so that you sort of understand why the speaker or writer spoke or write what they did. again, you know, the less text we provide, the more opportunity you have to just read the historical document itself. And so, again, just very light on the background information, and we are in no way advocating one way or the other for a particular outcome on any of the constitutional issues at bar in the Shelby County case. We leave that to the advocates who we've shared this document with, and we also share it with the general public. It will be available on our blog at blog.consource.org later today. Eventually, our education team will adapt this document for use by educators in secondary school classrooms.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I was a law student or when I was a young associate attorney doing all kinds of research for the partners on short deadlines, I would have loved to stumble across something like this.
Because that's our hope, that there's someone else in a firm somewhere who will be very happy that they were either sent this directly or stumbled upon it on the Internet.
Oh, absolutely. No, it looks like more than just a starting point, too, because I'm scrolling through this as we're speaking, and I'm up to page 32 now. And it's just, I mean, just to read this would take a significant amount of time, and to absorb it would take longer. And then it's full of links to the original sources, the original statutes, the original cases. It's a really enhanced roadmap to understanding all the background and context of this.
It is certainly a very rich document. We try to include a lot of content, but it's by no means an exhaustive survey of all of the historical materials that are relevant to the Shelby County case, or just generally to an exploration of the 15th Amendment and its enforcement power. What we did try to do was select documents that drew out some really interesting themes and constitutional issues that were considered by the drafters and ratifiers of the 15th Amendment, and then, of course, you know, things that would be relevant to the current challenge. And so we hope we've given a really nice sampling of that, and by providing links to the documents either in our online library or other reputable online storehouses of primary source materials. You know, we hope we've provided a really rich trail of historical breadcrumbs, if you want to say that, to sort of greater
trail of historical
breadcrumbs.
I like that phrase.
Yeah.
Well, as I've been listening to you, and I have been listening very carefully, but I've also been scrolling down, and I finally made it to page 55. And the only thing I don't see in this document is a signature block. Who actually put this together for you?
Yep. So this document was prepared by Consource staff members, mm-hmm. research fellows at Harvard Law School participating in our SCOTUS source program,
mm-hmm.
and Carl Cicieri, who's a member of our legal advisory board and an appellate attorney at Hankinson LLP down in Texas.
So basically you got an appellate attorney who's knowledgeable in this area, and then he mm-hmm. is supervising a bunch of Harvard Law School students to do this research?
Mm-hmm. And then we have research fellows on the Consource team, and then myself as executive director, I was also very much so involved in the research on this particular topic, just because I have an interest in voting rights.
Mm-hmm. Now, Consource is a relatively new entity. How long has it been around?
Since 2005, actually.
Oh, that long. I didn't realize mm-hmm. it was quite that long that you all had been done here. So have you done this before then? You put together these sorts of research guides?
Mm-hmm. We have done this a number of times. We prepared a document related to the Affordable Care Act challenge, mm-hmm. To the Fisher v. UT Austin affirmative action case, and now this document compilation for Shelby County v. Holder. And we will continue to do these different constitutional issues arise, you know, either before the U.S. Supreme Court or lower federal court, and we think history could shed some interesting light on the constitutional issues. We will continue to prepare these sort of neutral research reports for a variety of different uses.
And that's a wrap. Thanks so very much to Julie Silverbrook of Consource. Thanks also, of course, to Chris Phillips, who is the author of the Constitution Cafe and the operator of a website called Democracy Cafe. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are part of the American experiment.